waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. We were thinking last evening of the glorious truth of the sonship of the believer and the thrilling fact that we have been adopted into the family of God. Now it is one thing to be adopted into a family. It is something else again to be adapted for life in this family. This is the theme that the apostle picks up in verses 18 to 27. Suffering or groaning is mentioned three times in the context. You have the groaning of the creation in the verses that we have read, verses 18 to 22. You have the groaning of the Christian in verses 23 to 25. And most mysterious of all, you have the groaning of the Comforter in verses 26 to 27. I want to speak this morning on the groaning of creation. Imagine a wealthy gentleman, Christian gentleman, going down to the Chicago slums and picking up off the street a dirty, ragged, unkempt, foul-mouthed little boy, taking him home and putting him in his family. There would be some adjusting to be done. It would be one thing to adopt him into the family. It would be something else again to adapt him. God reached down into the filth and the muck and the mire of the gutter of sin and picked us up. He's put us in the royal family of heaven. We are sons of God, joint heirs with Jesus Christ. We have been adopted into the family of God. There's quite a bit of adjusting to be done. This process of adaption following our adoption can be very painful. I suppose Mark Twain brings it out as good as anybody in his book Tom Sawyer. Do you remember how that disreputable young character, Huckleberry Finn, was adopted at the end of the book by the widow Douglas? He had come into some money, you see, they'd found it, and this widow, feeling sorry for Huckleberry Finn, whose father was the town drunkard, who lived a vile and unkempt life, she felt sorry for him and she decided to bring him under her protection. Says Mark Twain, Huck Finn's wealth and the fact that he was now under the widow Douglas' protection introduced him into society. No, dragged him into it, hurled him into it, and his sufferings were almost more than he could bear. The widow's servants kept him clean and neat, combed and brushed. They bedded him nightly in unsympathetic sheets that had not one little spot or stain which he could press to his heart and know for a friend. He had to eat with a knife and fork. He had to use napkin, cup, and plate. He had to learn his book. He had to go to church. He had to talk properly so that speech was become insipid in his mouth. Whithersoever he turned, the bars and shackles of civilization shut him in and bound him hand and foot. Mark Twain tells us that Huckleberry Finn stuck it for about 3 weeks. And then he turned up missing. Tom Sawyer knew where to find him. Among some old empty hogsheads, down behind the abandoned slaughterhouse. Says Mark Twain, Huck had slept there. He had just breakfasted upon some stolen odds and ends of food and was lying now in comfort with his pipe. He was unkempt, uncombed, and clad in the same old ruin of rags that had made him picturesque in the days when he was free and happy. Did you notice that one expression? His sufferings were almost more than he could bear. Now, I'm sure we all thrilled last night to the glorious truth of adoption. We're going to think of the adaption this morning. It's no wonder that Paul introduces this section by saying, I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. In other words, what Paul is saying here is this. All that we have to go through between the time that we're saved and the time that we're taken home to heaven, it's all going to be worth it. By and by. Paul joins together here, by the way, two words that are usually kept together in the Bible. The sufferings and the glory. Remember how Peter puts them together? He says to the elders, I also am an elder and a witness of the sufferings and a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Do you ever stop to think that this is the basic difference between Peter and Paul? Peter was a witness of the sufferings and a partaker of the glory. Paul, on the other hand, was a partaker. He was a witness of the glory and a partaker of the sufferings. Peter was a witness of the sufferings at Gethsemane, at Gabbatha, and at Golgotha. He was a partaker of the glory on the Mount of Transfiguration. The Apostle Paul, on the other hand, was a witness of the glory. First of all, on the Damascus Road, when he saw that light above the brightness of the noonday sun, he was a witness of a glory later on when he was caught up into the third heaven and saw things untranslatable. But my word, he was a partaker of the sufferings. I'm very fond of the way that J.B. Phillips renders it in his paraphrase of that great passage in Corinthians dealing with Paul's sufferings. Paul puts it this way. He says, this is a silly game. But look at this list. I've worked harder than any of them, that is, his detractors. I've served more prison sentences. I've been beaten times without number. I've faced death again and again. I've been beaten with the regulation 39 stripes of the Jews 5 times. I've been beaten with rods 3 times. I've been stoned once. I've been shipwrecked 3 times. I've been 24 hours in the open sea. In my travels, I've been in constant danger from rivers and floods, from bandits, from my own countrymen, and from pagans. I have faced danger in the city streets, danger in the desert, danger on the high seas, danger amongst false brethren. I have known exhaustion, pain, long vigil, hunger and thirst, doing without meals, cold, and lack of clothing. Paul knew what he was talking about, you see, when he said, I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed. In my opinion, he says, using the J.B. Phillips paraphrase again, in my opinion, what we have to go through now is less than nothing compared with the magnificent future God has planned for us. Now, in some wonderful way that Paul is going to develop in these verses, the whole creation has a vested interest in the final adaption of the sons of God. The whole creation, you see, is going to share in what is going to happen some golden daybreak, school days all past, when the sons of God finally come into their inheritance. That day hasn't come yet, but creation has a vested interest in what will happen when it does. And Paul sets before us in these few verses four things about the creation that should occupy our attention. First of all, he reminds us that we are living, in verse 19, we are living in a retarded world. He says, the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. Now, I understand from books that expression, earnest expectation, means anxious looking with outstretched head. Have you ever seen a little boy at a parade? You know, he kind of elbows his way to the front. And then all of a sudden he hears the drums. He hears the band. He can't see. So he stands on tiptoe. And he cranes his neck and he stretches himself to see. Ah, there it is, he can see it now. That's what Paul's talking about here. J.B. Phillips puts it this way. The whole creation is on tiptoe to see the wonderful sight of the sons of God coming into their own. In other words, Paul uses a personification here, and he shows us the creation, as it were, straining every nerve, waiting to see that day. In the meantime, we have a retarded world. When God planned in the creation to put man in the garden, he intended, of course, that man should take this beautiful world that had come from the hands of God and bring it to its fullest possible pitch of development. All the tremendous latent power that lay in that fresh world from the hands of God, and God placed Adam there to bring it to its very highest pitch of perfection. You know what Adam did? He stole something that he wasn't to have. And the fall of man blighted man's ability to subdue the earth the way God meant it to be subdued. Today there are trackless deserts in the world which are a direct result of man's mismanagement of his estate. Today, you don't have to travel far, even across this country, to see ugly scars where man has stripped mined the soil in his greed for gain and left behind him a desolation. Years ago, a man named Richard Llewellyn wrote a classic story that was later made into a famous moving picture called How Green Was My Valley. It's a haunting tale of a Welsh valley. You can hear the very rolling cadences of the sing-song Welsh even as you read it. The story begins with these words. Hugh Morgan is speaking. Not that one. I don't think he's even got a drop of Welsh blood in him. Well, the true Hugh Morgan is speaking, you see. listen to the Welsh. He says, I am going, he says, to pack my blue shirt with my other socks and my best suit and my little blue cloth, in the little blue cloth that my mother used to tie around her hair when she did the house. And I am going from the valley. It's the story of a large family, the Morgans, whose livelihood depended on mining in the late 19th century, when South Wales still prospered and the coal dust had not blackened the valley. One of the closing chapters of the story begins when Hugh Morgan asks a foreman from the pit why they were erecting a conveyor system from the mouth of the pit to the top of the hill. He was told that it was, to use the technical expression of the mine, it was for slag tip. Slag, of course, was a waste product that was mined along with the coal. It was utterly worthless. And this conveyor belt was to take the slag that was mined with the coal, ugly black stuff, but useless as fuel. They were going to take it from the mine and they were going to dump it on top of the mountain. Hugh Morgan looked at the foreman and he said, but it will roll down on top of us. In time to come, I suppose, said the foreman, taking no interest. He added cynically, years yet. Hugh Morgan went home and talked it over with his father, who'd spent all his life in the mines. The old days, you see, when they dug out the coal, they kept the slag and they put it back in the mine again. Said the old man, the slag must go somewhere. If they keep it underground as they used to do, it will have to come from the wages of the men. While they are piling slag, they cannot be cutting coal. One of the two, so the mountain it is for the sake of the wages. So they piled the slag upon the mountains. They filled the valleys with the stuff. They built man-made mountains with heaps of black, ugly coal slag. When I was a little boy, I often went up those Welsh valleys with my father. He went preaching. Places with such resounding Welsh names as Abergavenny, as Pontypridd and Llanelli and Bargoed. Wonderful little mountain villages in Wales. Great assemblies up there, you should hear them sing. I can still remember, it comes back as clear as can be in my mind's eye, those great coal-black mountains of ugliness. Mighty monuments to man's human greed. Titanic tribute to the mismanagement by man of his fair estate. Gone are those green valleys of Wales. Instead, you'll find dismal towns of ugly brick. Houses rammed together in long, ugly lines. Front doors opening straight out onto the street. And scarcely a green thing to be seen. The keepers of the vineyard have made havoc of the beautiful estates that God once placed into their hands.
We are living in a retarded world.
Listen, you don't have to go to South Wales to see that kind of thing. A few years ago, I was in the city of Cleveland ministering over the weekend in the assembly there. And I spent the weekend with a dear brother at a very beautiful home in one of the Cleveland suburbs. It was Saturday evening when I came in. It was dark when I went to his home. When I opened the shades on the Sunday morning and looked out of the window for the first time, I was amazed to see that his house was built right on a cliff overlooking the lake, Lake Erie. I remember coming down for breakfast that morning and looking out of the picture window at the back of the house and seeing the garden, and then at the end of the garden of Pence, and there below the garden, the shimmering waters of the lake, beautiful in the morning sunshine. I said to the brother, I said, can you get down to the lake from here? Oh yes, he said, there's a pass at the back, you can get down. I said, you must enjoy it. Do you have a beach down there? No, he said. Kind of laughed. He said, you can't swim in Lake Erie. It's completely polluted. He says, it's full of industrial waste. Nobody thinks of swimming in Lake Erie. Man's mismanagement of his estate. I don't even have to go to Cleveland to see that. A few months ago, I had to leave Moody Bible Institute and go up to Milwaukee. So I checked out an Institute car. The thing had been sat in the parking lot for about 3 days. It had African measles. You know, when you get German measles, you break out in swastikas. Well, this thing had African measles. It was covered all over with great big black spots. It had soot all over it from the factory chimneys all around. In fact, my office looks out on LaSalle Street in Chicago. You don't dare open your window and take a deep breath, you choke to death. Oh, I tell you, we're living in a retarded world. Under gross mismanagement because of man's sin. It's no wonder that Paul says that the whole creation stands on tiptoe to see the sons of God coming into their own, this inanimate creation of ours. Paul personifies it, and he says it can't wait for that day. What you're being trained for, my brother? We are living in a retarded world. We are living in what we could call advisedly, and I use the word not because it fits my alliterative pattern, because it's what the word really means. We are living in a resultless world. Paul says the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. That word vanity, according to Kenneth Wiest in his commentary on Romans, means idle, resultless, futile, aimless. The New English Bible translates this statement, it was made the victim of frustration. The Revised Standard Version puts it this way, the creation was subjected to futility. There's a note in the margin of the Companion Bible on the word vanity that is used here. The author of the Companion Bible points out that the meaning is disappointing misery. And he says it's used, the word vanity here, is used in the same sense that the word vanity is used in the book of Ecclesiastes. If there's one thing that impresses the reader of the book of Ecclesiastes more than anything else, it is Solomon's restlessness. his sense of utter futility and the disappointing misery of his life at the end of his days. Nothing satisfied him. Everything at last came to an end. He just had lived a resultless life as far as God was concerned. The word of future. I understand it's the same word or the same thought that you have in the Hebrew word in the early chapter of Genesis. You remember when Eve and Adam had their first child? They called him Cain. That was an expression of their faith in the promise of God, that from the woman would come the Redeemer. She says, I have gotten the man from the law. I've gotten the man. She thought that Cain was Christ. Bless her heart. Oh, by the time Abel was born, she found her mistake. She saw some of the temper tantrums of that little boy. She found out how deeply rooted the whole principle of sin was in the heart of that firstborn son of the human race. His lies, his hypocrisy, his bad temper. He wasn't the Christ. When Abel was born, do you know what she called him? She called him Abel. Do you know what that means? Vanity. Vanity. The same Hebrew word. We are living in a disappointing world. A resultless world. All because of sin. In verse 21, Paul tells us that we are living in a redeemed world. Because, he says, the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Now this, of course, looks forward to the day when men shall learn war no more, when the lion shall lie down with the lamb, when swords shall be beaten into plowshares, when the desert shall blossom like the rose, when the reaper shall overtake the sower, and when a man will be young at 100 years of age. Because you see, the creation is a partaker in the redemption. God sent into this world in the fullness of time a second man, a last Adam. He came to restore that which he took not away. And he not only redeemed the human race, he redeemed the creation. It's illustrated, of course, in the book of Ruth. You remember in the book of Ruth when Boaz fell in love with Ruth and wanted to redeem her. He had to redeem two things. He had to redeem Ruth, but he also had to redeem her property. There was a near kinsman. He was very interested in the property, but he wasn't a bit interested in the property when he found out that to get the property he had to marry the person. He didn't want to mar his inheritance. I wonder what he meant by that. I wonder why that near kinsman was afraid of marring his inheritance and why Boaz didn't care. You know? Now this may not be the ultimate answer, but this is an answer that appeals to me. You see, every Hebrew, devout Hebrew, lived in hope and anticipation that his family would be the royal family, that through his line would come the Messiah. This nearer kinsman didn't want to mar his inheritance. He didn't want to spoil his chances of the Messiah coming through his line by marrying a pagan. Boaz didn't care about that. You know why? Well, his inheritance was already marred. His mother was Rahab the harlot. Yet it was from this line that the Messiah came. But the point I want to make this morning is this, that when Boaz redeemed the person, at the same time he redeemed the property. And he got both in the one act. On the cross of Calvary, the Lord Jesus not only redeemed our persons, he also redeemed our property. And so the creation, shall also be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the people of God. And you know, the mind of man is totally unable to conceive what this poor, battered old world is going to be like when Jesus comes and lifts the curse, and a redeemed planet is to be populated by a redeemed people. Not even the most glowing accounts of the Old Testament prophets can give us more than the vaguest outline of the glory which shall be revealed when the creation too enters into the glorious liberty of the sons of God. That's what's coming by and by. But before he finishes on this theme, Paul brings us back to present reality. And he leaves us with a picture of what is today, presently, at this moment, a ruined world. He says in verse 22, we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. Someone has said that all the sounds of nature are pitched in a minor key. We think of the sighing of the wind, the howling of the gale, the baying of a wolf at the moon, the night cry of an owl, the prowling squeal of a cat, the bleating of a sheep, the lowing of an ox. We're living in a sad world. In fact, the world in which we live is one vast graveyard. Robert Louis Stevenson caught the picture of it all in his famous poem, On a Tropical Rain Forest. Listen to these words. See if you can't see something of the groaning of the creation. This ruined world, this world of living death, this world which is one vast graveyard from end to end. He's describing a tropical rainforest, and this is what he says. There, he says, there the green murderer throve and spread, upon his smothered victims fed, and wantoned in his climbing coil, contending roots forth to the soil. Like frightened demons, with despair, competing branches pushed for air. Green conquerors from overhead bestowed the bodies of their dead. And in the groins of branches low, the cancers of the orchids grow. So hushed the woodland warfare goes, unceasing, and the silent foes grapple and smother, strain and cast, without a cry, without a gasp. This very kind of thing that caused Charles Darwin to write his book on the origin of species by natural selection. Looking at a ruined world. But you know, there's hope. And the hope is this. One day, the sons of God are going to come into their own. Everything in this section of the chapter is focused, you see, on the sons of God. Right now, we who have been adopted into the family of God are being adapted for our high destiny. It is part of our training that we should have to live in this sin-cursed world as sons of God. My brother, it is a dignity that the very angels could covet. God has bestowed upon us a dignity that drives the devil mad. God expects us to act in our present environment, whatever that environment may be, as sons and daughters of a king. He expects us to respond to the circumstances of life with grace and poise and as the heirs of heaven. We are not to be Huckleberry Tins. We are to be sons of God. How are you reacting to it? Your circumstances in life? In this groaning world in which we live, is there something about you? Is there something about me? Is there something about us, brethren and sisters, that marks us out as children of God, isn't it? Are we living as those who are joint heirs with Jesus Christ? May God help us to enter into the truths of these great chapters, that wherever he may place us, wherever we may be, whenever it is, at all times, in all places, under all circumstances, come what may, we may behave like the children of a king. I'm going to ask that we sing that hymn 173. Behold what love, what boundless love the Father hath bestowed on sinners lost, that we should be now called the sons of God. What we in glory soon shall be, it doth not yet appear, but when our precious Lord we see, we shall his image bear. With such a blessed hope in view, we would more holy be, more like our risen, glorious Lord, whose face we soon shall see.